Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning.
Now, I guess we're going to be wrapping up, reluctantly, I might add, our Toscana trip.
Well, the memories will still be ripe until the next time we go. That's all you can say. We really had a wonderful time. And one of the most interesting places that we stayed...
It's
classed as a luxury bed and breakfast. It's the dream of John Voigtman and his wife. And why don't we just listen to John tell the story?
As we were driving for 3 kilometers up this dirt road, bouncing around among the little scattered rocks, curving around, I'm thinking to myself, we were en route to La Bandita to stay. What kind of crazy fool would build this place and here? And so here we are talking to John Voigtman, who was the crazy fool. And it turns out you weren't so crazy after all.
Well, maybe I am crazy, but at least there are other crazy people that want to drive up the road as well that we've been lucky enough to find. We really fell in love with the Val d'Orcia. We fell in love with this valley and this area, and particularly this nature reserve that we're in right now. And the only way to get here is that bumpy dirt road. So
we did it by night last night.
And you did it by night. Exactly. You did well.
I understand there's actually another road, which is even bumpier.
Oh, yeah, you came up the good road.
I go up
and down the bad road. Yeah.
But you can get an idea, I think, of the kind of unique personality that John is when I tell you that among the treasures downstairs at La Bandita is an award for the sale of more than 900,000 copies of a movie he never expected anyone would recognize, but which resonated with people around the world, called A Full Monty.
Yes.
So I guess if you can get a success doing that, you can be a success doing anything.
I guess so. I mean, that was a big surprise to all of us, and it was kind of early in my marketing career for Sony and RCA, and I was so lucky because the movie was just a sensation. I did very little, but I got a lot of credit for standing in the right place at the right time.
But you get all the credit for the pioneering that says you found what was the building. Was it derelict when you bought
it? Yes, yeah, totally derelict with animals, with sheep and cows living on the ground floor and pigs in the suite, which is why we call it the pigsty suite.
And when did that transformation begin?
That started in 2006. So from 2005 to 2006, it was sort of a year getting the permits to do the building work, to build a swimming pool, to change this from a rural estate into a business. And then from 2006 to 2007 was a full year of renovation work on the building, and then we opened in the summer of 2007.
Now, but your love of Tuscany and the reason that you and your wife are here dated before that.
Yes.
Correct?
So, you know, it had been kind of almost 10 years of going back and forth, looking at places, getting to know the area, wondering if this was the right thing that we wanted to do, thinking about leaving New York. All of those things take years as you're percolating over them in your mind. But it was really getting married to my wife in Tuscany while we were living in New York was the beginning of the process that allowed us to fall in love with the area and think about spending more time here.
Now, why is it called La Bandita?
You know, La Bandita is the original name of the farm. Yeah, and it is a term that's relatively common. There are lots of La Banditas in Tuscany and in Italy in general. It's sort of a name for a farm that's far away. I think it means a band area, like a preserve.
Oh, I thought it meant a bandit.
It can mean a female bandit too, but
that's right.
So which is
rare,
which is rare, but exists for sure. But it's funny there are several other La Banditas even around here, so it gets very confusing sometimes for the.
Well, you know, you seem to be fairly isolated, but there are all kinds of activities well within reach of this location.
Yes. I mean, what we were really looking for and what made this place so ideal for us, we wanted to have the true feeling of being totally in another world and being very remote. So the 3 kilometers of the road is sort of a spiritual transition away from wherever you've come from, and you arrive at a place that you really want to arrive to. And then you have this vast view where it just seems like you're in the middle of nowhere. But we're within less than a 30-minute drive to 5 of the most beautiful villages in Tuscany. We're 2 hours from the center of Rome, an hour and a half from the center of Florence.
For those people who don't know Tuscany, give us the 5.
So I would say Bagnavignone, San Quirico, Montalcino, Montepulciano, Pienza are all beautiful little medieval walled villages that are total gems to visit. And, you know, they're within 15 to 30 minutes away.
Now,
so
we went to one last night called
Montichiello. That would be the sixth.
Which is unusual in that it really is an intact, medieval village, I guess you would call it, complete with walls and towers and everything.
Absolutely, totally intact. And full of, there's only one restaurant in there and one part-time shop, and that's the rest are just people living in there.
Now, what would someone expect to experience coming here? And we, of course, know because we've been here for 2 days.
Yeah.
We've also bonded with all these other guests, which is wonderful. But explain, since you call it a luxury B&B, what people should expect.
Sure. Well, it's a country house and, you know, in the middle of the
countryside.
But
beautifully designed.
But on the inside, and it's an old stone farmhouse building on the outside, but on the inside we've changed and renovated everything so that it's very bright and very comfortable, but also very modern, and we've put some modern pieces of furniture and some colorful pieces on the walls and in the showers, for instance,
interested in plumbing, and this is very
exactly.
modern plumbing.
So everything is new in terms of the plumbing, the heating, the cooling, and the furniture, and all of those things were designed by us to be totally comfortable and luxurious. And the beds are nice, the sheets are nice, the showers
are very, very good. Yeah, for some of you, it was a bad back. I was real thrilled.
Good. It's something I'm very sensitive to as well. So you can expect to find an old house on the inside and a brand new modern house on the inside.
You mean an old house on the outside?
Oh, an old house on the outside and a brand new modern house on the inside.
People are here at any one time.
16 people is really the maximum because we have 8 double rooms. And what you can expect is that there's sort of a young, friendly staff that's here to help you to plan your day, to what activities that you want to do, to give you some advice on where to go, to help show you the way, and also that there every night there's a sort of a dinner party that you can partake in or not partake in, as you wish.
We do
wine tastings, and we drink a lot of wine. We eat a lot of good food. We try to be very seasonal. We have a chef who sort of cooks every night. We have two chefs who alternate, and so that every night there's a beautiful dinner awaiting you if you want to eat in. Otherwise, we can point you in the direction of a little trattoria in a local town.
You do three meals, which is really unusual for a B&B.
Yeah, and we do lunch too, because during the summer, obviously we do breakfast, but in the summertime, it's a lot of people stay around all day because you just go down to the pool and relax and take a walk. So you have lunch by the pool and then come back, take a rest and have a nice dinner and drink a nice bottle of wine.
It looks like you can eat outside too. There's a little,
What
do you call it? A cabana, whatever you call it.
Yeah, there's several different outdoor dining areas. There's one right in the front here. There's one on the side. I don't know if you've seen and down by the pool as well. And the suite has its own dining area. So when the weather's nice, it's really easy to have maybe 4 or 5 dinners going on at the same time. So we don't have to have everybody together. But I've found that it's something that people really enjoy while they're traveling, to kind of meet up on a windy hillside with other travelers and exchange stories and exchange discoveries and share a nice bottle of wine. So it's really nice.
There have been some fascinating guests. There's been turnover of guests. We've only been here 2 days. There's been turnover of guests. But the energy has been there, sitting around the dining room table after dinner, drinking wine and talking till way past my ordinary bedtime.
Good. We like that. And something that we really tried to accomplish, and I'm really happy to see it happening, is that we have an international group of people here always. And it would be less interesting for me if everyone was American or everyone was British. But it's not unusual, as we had the other night, somebody from Colombia, somebody from Brazil, somebody from Australia, somebody from Canada, somebody from America, and maybe somebody from Germany, all at the same dinner table. For me, that keeps things a little bit more interesting.
Right. Just give us some particulars as to how one gets a reservation here.
Well, one just goes easily to our website at la-bandita.com. There's a button that sends me an email, and I'll respond right away because I'm still like a BlackBerry addicted New Yorker, so I'll respond to emails anytime, anywhere.
I can assure you that John is the fastest email respondent of all the people I've dealt with in Italy.
BlackBerry and an iPhone.
There we go. So you're on the go, and it was wonderful of you to deal with your family chores this morning and still get here by 9 o'clock.
Yeah, we do. I mean, the idea is that we not only provide you with a nice bed and some food, but we really give you a little bit of advice. And I like to have direct contact with people before they come, first of all, so I can just explain to them that it's a bit of an unusual place, that not only is there a bumpy road, but that you have to be aware of before you come, because it might not be something that you want to do, and that's fine, but also that it is a very communal atmosphere, that you'll be bumping in and seeing your other guests, and that, but also that we can sort of guide you to the right places. I've been living here as a traveler myself for 6 years now, so I found some nice places that I'm willing to share. And my wife is a travel writer as a profession, so she's, you know, knows how to recommend things for people. So we find that to be a real resource for our guests. I mean, sometimes people know the area and know what they want to do and are totally fine. Sometimes our Italian guests know what they want to do as well, and they're not interested in my recommendations. But a lot of times people, it is a benefit to them.
And you're moving on to yet another project.
Yes, we're in Pienza. Yeah, we're doing a kind of a townhouse hotel in the center of the old town of Pienza. Pienza is a very small, very beautiful little Renaissance gem.
Well, you have parking.
Exactly. Parking is the big problem in Pienza.
Yes,
so.
We stayed there 7 years ago. We stayed at the Chiostro.
At the Chiostro, yeah.
But I had to move, and I could leave the car out front during the day, but I had to move it out at night.
Yes.
Fortunately, there is parking just outside the city.
Yes.
But listeners, I'm sure this is going to be a wonderful place to stay. When is it likely to open?
Probably 2012. So it has a big renovation.
And it's going to be a wine bar.
It'll be a wine bar, a little kind of wine bar with Italian snacks, a sort of a one room spa, a nice garden outdoor area, and 13 guest rooms.
Now, one thing I will tell you, listeners, the one challenge that we found, John's directions are terrific, absolutely terrific, describing every step along the way till you get to the green sign called La Bandita, and then there's more directions along the way up the 3.5 kilometers of dirt road as well. But returning at night,
very difficult,
from the Pienza direction,
it's
a real challenge to find the turnoff.
Yes.
The secret is there are actually road signs for the, tell us the name of the agriturismo.
Lucilabella.
Lucilabella.
Yes.
There actually is an advance warning sign about 2
yes.
kilometers away,
yeah.
another one 500 meters away.
Exactly.
And you can just about find it as long as the driver behind you isn't getting really impatient.
Yeah, because you have to go very slow, otherwise you can totally miss the dirt road as well.
That's exactly what we did. Like,
that's good advice.
Slowly, which was a smart thing to do. We got here safely. Anne was worried every time we came up the road. I candidly wasn't really all that worried because I did have four-wheel drive.
Oh, wow, you did.
Well, I didn't use it.
Yeah.
But it was there if I needed it. And we're going to be sad to be saying goodbye today, but we must say goodbye so we can come back.
Great.
And we hope that listeners, that you all take advantage of the wonderful opportunity to experience Tuscany really close to the ground, which is where we are. I mean, you're in touch with the earth of Tuscany right here.
Absolutely.
You were looking for, and I think it's what a lot of people were looking for, and here would be a great place to enjoy that. Don't you think, sweetheart?
Yes, I mean, I loved every minute of it, John. Thank you very much.
Great. My pleasure. It was great having you.
One of the really interesting things about staying at La Bandita is getting together for dinner every evening, sometimes with a wine tasting, always with lots of wine, and Chef David, who's an unusual in that he's cooking Italian style, but he's from Scotland.
Yeah, and it's an open kitchen, so you're very close to everything.
Yeah, I mean, he's just part of the whole thing, and right after dinner, he'd probably come and sit down and have a glass of wine and chat with you. And we caught up with him, so we'd have the opportunity to hear more about his particular story, which is interesting in its own right, and to talk about the kinds of things that he's doing in the culinary department at La Bandita, which you're sure to enjoy.
Our guest at this moment knows that there are lots of jokes in England where there was an Englishman, an Irishman, and a Scotsman. Mm. Well, in this case, we have an Englishman, a Scotsman, and an Italian.
gathered
around the interview place, just in case you're wondering. The Englishman is Peter. Our guest, David Mangan, is the chef at a wonderful property in out-of-the-way Tuscany called La Bandita. He's been here since before the beginning, he told us, and we're going to talk to him about that. And, of course, the Italian is my lovely wife sitting on my left.
Yes.
But we're always interested.
I couldn't believe where we were going. It was the bumpiest dirt road I've been in for a long time.
What did you say? The food better be good? we'll check that out, listeners. But seriously, you got off, David, you got off to a rather unusual start for a chef. Go ahead. Tell us the story.
For me, it was kind of unusual because when I left school, I originally trained to be a butcher, which, as you guys were saying before, it's become a celebrity sort of status in the U.S. now. Whereas for me at that time, it wasn't really.
No, it wasn't so glamorous then.
No, it wasn't so glamorous at all. So, you know, I went on with my apprenticeship, and then I left it. And then being young, growing up, you know, I didn't really take things very, very seriously.
You were 16, you said.
Yeah, when I left school, very young. So my parents said to me, go and work. So, you know, I took that job because it was the first one that was available to me. And it was at a very good level to do something like that. So I did the apprenticeship, then I kind of left it. And I kind of moseyed around little restaurants and bars and worked here and there. And then I really didn't take things seriously until I was 23, 24.
That was quite some time. It took you a long time to come around there.
Yeah. And what happened was I decided my original plan was to be become qualified as a chef and then move to Australia, to Perth. That was the actual plan. So I went back.
Well, you only went 90 degrees to the right.
Yeah, of course.
stayed north of the Australia.
Yeah, and it was, you know, that was a bit of a shock as well.
But you told us that the single step that was important was when you went to the second most famous golfing destination in Scotland, Glen Eagle.
Yeah.
And not only did you get experience there, but something else happened that was really important in your life.
Yeah, I fixed my golf swing.
you said you were going to leave and then you allowed yourself to be talked out of it.
You acquired a mentor,
yeah,
basically.
You know, I'd been there for a little while and I was offered a job back in Glasgow, and you know, Glasgow now is a city that's very much booming, and the reason I withdrew my notice was because the chef pulled me into the office on the final night of my notice and taught me out of it. He said to me, if you leave here, you just mosey around, do what you were doing before. And he said, if you stay with me another little while, then basically you'll go anywhere in the world. And I kind of owe him for that because this is where I'm sitting now talking to you.
Well, you obviously had talent because all these people who knew what they were doing selected you as being talented and supported you. So you must have a natural.
Yeah. You know, the cooking I was doing in Glen Eagles was a bit different to what it is here.
Right.
You know, especially in Tuscany, things are very, very simply done. So for me, part of the challenge was adapting to that style, which was fun and also very difficult. But now, having been here for 5 years nearly, it's starting to show through. And it's kind of nice, especially when we have Italian guests here. You know, I used to get very, very nervous when they arrived. but now it's very much fun to be.
Now, you cook locally. I mean, everything is locally based.
Everything that we buy here at La Vendita, we source from Pienza. The original plan was to spend as much money in the comune of Pienza as possible. So my butcher, I buy all of my meat, all the cooked meats, prosciuttos, from him. All the pecorino cheeses are all from this area.
And your style of cooking, though, you adhere to traditional recipes?
Yeah, I will do traditional food, but also I like to do it just a little bit more modern as well. It's kind of my own take on what I like to do here at La Vendita.
Now, what's on? You showed me already, but
yeah.
Let's have our listeners drool over what's on the menu.
So for tonight, I had a butternut squash soup, and this is actually very, very close to me because it's from my girlfriend's dad's garden. So you know, you can't get any better than that.
Then a curious question. Usually butternut squash soup has cream in it.
Yeah.
Now, someone was last night, who's lived in Italy for 40 years, I asked in the restaurant if there was cream in something, and she blew her stack saying, you're in Italy, and Italians do not use cream.
Yeah, no, you know, that's one thing I don't agree with either, is putting cream into soups.
So my question basically is, what are you putting in? Because I've only seen it with cream in it.
Okay, basically tonight the soup is just roasted butternut squash, onions, carrots, garlic, a little bit of chili and water and salt and pepper.
That's great. I'm a cream phobe or whatever you call it. I don't like it either.
Okay.
Now, after that, there's a real special treat.
Yeah, so now here in Tuscany, as it's starting to rain, we've entered into the truffle season, the white truffles, which the one I got today was also from my butcher's dad, who's one of the there's two very famous truffle hunters in this area. And so I managed to get a hold of one today that weighed 100 grams.
Wow.
He found 10 of those this morning, and by 11 o'clock this morning, half of them were in Verona and the other half were in Rome. So I managed to get one, and it's very nice because I have the opportunity to go out in the morning with him very early and find these truffles.
In the dark, do you go?
Yeah, usually it's around 5 a.m. we go out. So tonight I've made pappardelle, and I made a white Tuscan ragu, which consists of rabbit, chicken, and turkey.
Oh, this sounds fabulous.
That's been cooking for about 9 hours now.
Oh, my.
And we're going to serve that with white truffle shavings over the top.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were not going to have pasta for dinner.
No, I was not going to eat dinner tonight. Okay. I couldn't even overeating, but I think I'm going to
You were not
going to
eat dinner. I knew you'd change your mind. And then the secondi is...
And then the secondi, what am I doing? I'm doing a loin of pork. And basically I've just put that into the oven 10 minutes ago, so that's going to cook nice and slowly for the next 2 hours. And I'm serving that with a white truffle puree of potato. And then I'm just going to serve that with some broccoli and cauliflower because they're in season just now. So that should be a very nice dinner.
Should be.
And then to finish off, we're actually going to do something that's not very Tuscan at all. We're going to do a very big chocolate souffle. So that is it's more like a tart, but it's a big chocolate souffle.
Now you're doing something. Tonight's meal is a little bit unusual, right? Because the property Lebanita is full.
Yeah, it's half full. There's only 10 here tonight for dinner. Usually in the summer months, usually from May till now, October, it's usually 16, 18, 20 people for dinner.
Okay. Oh, so tonight's a smaller meal than
usual. Yeah, so now getting into October, it's starting to come into the...
Well, do you do 3 meals a day?
I do 2 meals a day. I do lunch and dinner.
Oh, you do lunch too.
And I do that 6 days a week.
And
yeah, Monday's your day off, right?
So Monday's the chef's day off.
So we caught up with David today. It's actually Saturday evening as we're talking to him right now.
Well, now, you live far from here? Or?
I live in Kinchano Terme, which is about 25 minutes from La Bandita.
Uh-huh.
So it's all very much in this area.
Of which the last 15 minutes is on the Yellowstone Road.
Yeah, no, the road is a bit bumpy, but after 4 years for me, it's...
You don't even notice
it. No, I don't notice it. I don't notice it anymore.
Have you found that your reputation has spread so that you have people coming here as a destination to eat as well as just...
Yeah, over the past 2 seasons, that's certainly been the case. We have a lot more guests returning. We've got a lot of families that kind of class La Bandita's home now, as well as weddings. You know, this year we
weddings.
Did... Yeah, I think we did, if I remember rightly, we did 6 this year. We did 7 the year before, and I think next year we've got 5 booked already.
Wow.
Now, you're weaving this cooking in with John's love for wine, and you probably have developed a taste for the wine of this region yourself.
Yeah, no, yeah, for me, wine, especially from, you know, Tuscany, it's a new age wine. It's only really become, I've heard of in the past 100 years. And obviously, you know, I'm very fortunate. If we look out the window here, you've got Montalcino to one direction and Montepulciano the other direction. So we are very, very spoiled here in this area for wine. And yeah, I have learned a lot because John has got an incredible taste for wine. So I've developed my taste buds to that. Not as much as I'd like to, but I'd like to learn more. It's like cooking. You're continuously learning about wine as well.
Do you get to travel to see what's going on? This is fairly isolated, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty much here from April to November. So, you know, having been here since the beginning, I've kind of learned to switch off and just concentrate on this area and my work here. In the off period, you know, I generally like to go and work in other places. John allows me to do that. So last year, I ran a kitchen in the British Virgin Islands on British Virgin Gorda. The year before that, I was in Dubai.
Yeah, how's the Dubai scene?
It was, you know, Dubai is one of these places where whether you either love it or hate it. I've got a lot of friends that work there. After Glen Eagles, they also moved on to bigger hotels and do better things. So for me, it was kind of easy to settle in there. Whereas, you know, one in two people either, like I said, love it or hate it. I liked it, but to live there, I couldn't yeah. live there.
And where's next?
Well, I think that's kind of what I'm working out just now. Okay. You know, obviously I've got another month left to work, so that's the main focus is just getting through this season. There's two opportunities. One's either to go back to British Virgin Gorda, or the other one's to go and work in South Australia in Adelaide.
Where?
It's a new, it's an estate called Kingsbrook Estate.
So it's a winery basically?
Yeah, it's a winery. It's owned by a very famous sculptor called Chris. And it's actually his home that they developed into a four-bedroom boutique hotel.
That sounds like more fun than the other.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's kind of nice because they've got a restaurant there. It's in a courtyard and they only open it on a weekend. So I want to go over there and, you know, do a little bit more.
I think that would be a wonderful experience.
Yeah, no, it would be.
Plus you'll learn a whole lot of new wines.
Yeah, of course. And also, it's a bit warmer than going back to Scotland for
exactly.
the winter.
Well, you must let us know if you decide to do that, and we'll give you our own suggestions as to where might be some good places to go.
Yeah.
In South Australia, we were last there almost three years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a very exciting dining scene. It's a very exciting wine
yeah.
scene.
Yeah, all of Australia's kind of like
that.
Oh,
it's wonderful, yeah.
Yeah.
And Western Australia, when you talk about you wanted to go to Perth, I mean, the whole Margaret River Valley
yeah,
is wonderful.
That's where my original plan was to go to yeah. Perth.
Anyhow, well, I'm going to release you to your kitchen.
Thank you very much.
And I appreciate you taking your time to talk to us.
It's my pleasure.
You're so busy.
And we'll report back, listeners, as we put this show together. We'll report back and give David a score of 0 to 10.
Okay.
Where 10 is high.
Thanks, guys. No pressure.
I sort of suspect we're going to be right up. No pressure at all. just sounds like a winner. David, once again, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
Well, now, do stay with us while we take a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up is a book that's just glorious and big. It's a real lapidumer, as I call it. And it'll tell you just about as much, if not more, about whiskey than you'd ever want to know. Welcome, David Broom.
And just accused me of being biased and always wanting to be the one who talks to my fellow countrymen. But Dave Broom had just joined the program with the current situation of the government of Scotland under devolution. He might want to say, well, we're not fellow countrymen because you're from the south. You're a Sassenach and I'm from Glasgow. I don't know. What do you think? Are we both UK citizens? Is that okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. We're UK citizens. I live in England now anyway. I'm a sort of a cultural ambassador based there in Brighton. So, and my wife's English, so I'll be in big trouble if I say anything bad.
Well, thank you so much for joining the program. And listeners, before we came on the air, I asked Dave if he liked to be associated with someone else who did a signal contribution to the world of writing about whiskey, the man we call the other Michael Jackson, who sadly is looking down from heaven now at the work we're all doing. But I'm sure that if he has his eyes on the World Atlas of Whiskey, he would have a smile on his face, because Dave's new book has that title, and it's amazing coverage. Now, what made you decide to do this, Dave?
It was in kind of gestation for a whole number of years. I mean, people ask me how long the book took, and I say it was about 20 years and 3 months. It was, you know, it kind of came together over many years and of trying to explain whiskey to people and realizing that flavor was the best way to do that, and keeping things simple was a good way of doing it. And then trying to tell folk not just what whiskey tasted like, but why it tasted the way it did. And everything really came together very nicely just about a year ago with a publisher in London. I think I was in the right place at the right time. They were looking for a whiskey book, a companion volume to the World Atlas of Wine, and the rest, as they say, is history. So it was, the timing was very good, and especially good because there are so many new whiskies coming up from around the world, almost in every country you can imagine.
Has
distilleries in it now.
Yeah, I just read about some new thing, just like, was it in the New York Times or something just recently? A new one coming out of Japan where it's a whole different name. It's not shochu, but it sounds sort of like that kind of name. It's a whiskey.
Yep.
It's a scotch.
Well, there's a powerful section of Japanese whiskies, and if you remember when we talked to Michael, he said you'd be amazed at the quality of single malt scotch coming out of Japan. He said, I can't understand why the blended scotches are so bad when the single malts are so good, and perhaps you can shed some light on that for us, Dave.
The first important thing is it's Japanese single malt, not Scotch. So
right, okay.
Which is an important. That's kind of an important definition, really, because the Japanese make Japanese whiskey, so they use a Scottish template, but they have their own flavours, because of climate and because of approach. We think it's kind of new and remarkable. I've travelled a lot with Michael in Japan, actually, and it's interesting. Look at the Japanese whiskies, which are winning Best Whiskey in the World awards these days, and they're 20 years old. It's not a new thing. It's simply that we've been kind of slow in picking up on it. But the quality is, I would say, superb, and hate to disagree with Michael, but I think the blends that they're doing there, certainly at the moment, are every bit as good as the blends which are coming out of Scotland.
Well, there's one that I was telling you about. Have you read about that? I mean, that's a blend.
What are you looking at?
A new Japanese.
Well, you're on
blend.
A different, but you're on a different
page.
I'm
not talking about that.
Okay, you're not talking about a specific whiskey.
I'm talking about something I read just a couple of days ago.
Well,
yet another new one.
It's sure to be in this book, because I field tested this book with Dave before we came on the air, and of course, my big mouth, I said, I know there's a Scotch that's not in here. And he said, oh yeah, or something like that. So I looked in the book, and sure enough, in Western Australia, the Great Southern Distilling Company's single malt scotch is there. Now I have to tell you that Dave gets 100% for coverage, but he didn't have a comment, which Anne did when she tried it.
Oh, did I try it?
Yeah, we tried it. We also tried their gin and vodka, but the scotch, our conclusion was that it had a long way to go.
Yeah, but a lot of these guys are just kind of kicking off, and the whiskies they're releasing are young, but they've got to release them because they've got to get money in. But I think their enterprising nature is such, and their desire to make good whiskey is that, in a few years' time, they'll really come good. Yeah, you look at the other guys in Australia, in Tasmania, who've been doing it for 10 years, they are really, really good whiskies because they've got a bit of maturity on them now. You just got to give, it's whiskey, you got to give it time. You've got to allow these things. Same with the great craft distilling movement in the US at the moment. I mean,
oh, yes.
I was in Brooklyn last night, and found out that there's a distillery, Kings County Distillery in Brooklyn. So they're just starting off making whiskey. So,
there's the first one since Prohibition.
It's fantastic. It's a good time for whiskey around the world.
Now, how were you able to be so inclusive? Is it just your reputation that people know about you, and therefore if they have a whiskey that they're making, they get in touch with you? Or?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I've been writing for Whiskey Magazine, which is like the international title about whiskey. Ever since it was born, so that's over a dozen years, and I kind of travel the world and get to know folk, and although it's a big sprawling industry and it covers the globe, the community is relatively tight, so people tend to know what's going on, and I like to think I've got a good relationship with distillers, with a couple of exceptions, which is pointless going into, everybody was more than willing and really opened up their cellars, their barrels, their hearts to me. So big thanks to the industry as a whole, because if it wasn't for them,
wouldn't be anything after all, would there? Now, you do something even more important than simply cataloguing and identifying where all these different whiskey distilleries are and what regions they belong to. You actually have suggestions about, after you've tried this one, you might want to try this one next, which I thought was really absolutely fascinating approach. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, yes. People who are starting out on their whiskey journey, it's confusing and it's daunting. If you walk into a great retailer or a great whiskey bar or whatever, and you know, you look and you see a couple of brands you know, and then the rest are all called single malt scotch, you know, Glen something or whatever. And you don't know what they taste like. You say, well, I had a Glen last night, I might have a Glen tonight, you know. I think it's important to give people confidence and encourage them to start exploring, but you can't just. And again, coming back to the central theme of the book, which is, you know, tell them what the flavour of the whiskey is. And if they like the flavour of one well-known brand, such as Glenlivet or Glenmorangie or whatever, then, well, where do they go next in that journey? Well, you know, there's the flavour map at the beginning, and there's little suggestions as to where you can proceed with your journey.
So where do I go from Lafroy, which is my favourite?
You're already in the big peaty area, but you know I would move just up the road to Ardbeg, about 4 miles away. I would also head up to Kalila, which is on the east coast of Islay, which is a little bit lighter, or maybe up to Skye to Talisker and go for something like the phenomenal Talisker 18, and then finish off with something like Lagavulin 16 years old, which is a big and peat smoky. So even within the world of peat, there's variations. And then, having tried that, go all the way across to Japan and try a dram of Yuichi from Hokkaido. That will knock your socks off.
So you've got a real pathway. Now of course Scotch is, I guess, the big dog in terms of dominating the whiskey business in most of the rest of the world, except in these United States, and has earned that reputation over literally centuries of uninterrupted investigation and experimentation, you might say. One of the fascinating things that always surprised me the first few times I came across it is that the barrels used in Scotland to make whiskey actually come from different parts of the world. And if those different parts of the world didn't exist, we would have perhaps a very different product. Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I think to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, the Scotch template is a very strong one. But I think the important point to a couple of points, really, which is distillers around the world have always used what grows around them. So you know, if you were in Scotland, you know, you use barley because it was, you know, the hardiest grain in what is a relatively moist climate. It rains occasionally there. But you know, if you're in France, you get grapes, so you can make brandy. If you're in the Caribbean, you can use cane to make rum, or Mexico, use agave, etc., etc. So the evolution of the American whiskey industry was very much, you know, the distillers coming across and adapting what cereal crops grew and grew well in over here, and using their skills as distillers to craft new whiskies, and that's continuing to happen.
Now, I was going a different way in the making of Scotch, the use of used bourbon barrels and used sherry barrels have a tremendous influence on the flavour of a Scotch. What did they do before there was such a thing as a bourbon barrel?
Basically, the whole flavour profile of Scotch whisky has changed fairly significantly in the past 50, 60 years. If you go back to when the Scotch industry really kind of kicked off as a kind of commercial entity, which is the middle of the 19th century. Yeah, maturation was understood, but, you know, what are you going to put it in? There's not many oak trees in Scotland, because we cut them all down to build ships to go and fight the English, and, you know, so it's, you know, what do
you
we have?
You had to get that dig in there.
Of course. Do you like that? But, you know, as a nation which enjoys its alcohol, we imported a huge amount of sherry, of port, of wine, and of rum. So all these barrels would be landing on the docks of Leith and Glasgow and wherever, would be emptied, and the contents would be bottled, and the casks were emptied just at the same time as a whiskey industry was beginning to evolve. So
oh,
it made sense to press these empty barrels into service. But really the uptake in bourbon barrels, ex-bourbon barrels, came during the 20th century, basically from the 1950s onwards, because the law in the US to protect the jobs of the coopers, you know, says that you can only, to make a straight whiskey, you only use brand new barrels. So there's, suddenly as the American industry takes off again, there's lots of empty barrels lying around.
Great.
Being good Scots, we can see a bargain. and half the price of the barrels from sherry. So that's when the uptake begins to take place. Jerez, and as sherry begins to be bottled in Jerez, so the availability of barrels within Scotland begins to fall off. So you begin to see this shift away from the old sherried whiskies, if you want to call them that, into ones which show more, you know, vanilla character from ex-bourbon barrels. So yeah, there has been a shift.
Now let's come across to the United States, since that's from where we broadcast. Mm-hmm. And although we love our Scotch whiskey, we also, in my case, I love a good American whiskey as well.
Yeah.
I had a question, and I've never received a satisfactory answer to this question.
Uh-oh.
Well, you'll have an opinion about it, I'm sure, and I can share with you what, after you tell me what you think is the answer, I'll tell you what they told me was the answer.
Okay.
We had a group of five American whiskey makers around us at an event in Pittsburgh called the Pittsburgh Whiskey Festival last November.
Okay.
And I asked all of them, I said, why don't you make really old whiskeys? Why don't you keep the whiskey like the Scotch people do, where you can get whiskeys that are literally 60, 80, even 100 years old? Yep. You put yours out, and you think it's old at 8 years, and there are just a few exceptions where people are offering a 10 or a 12, but nothing like the... I mean, is there something wrong with your whiskey that doesn't have the longevity? What's going on?
All right, okay. Well, my answer to that is an interesting question. I would take one step back from that and really examine the assumption that the older a whiskey is, the better it is.
Which
isn't the case. The quality of a whiskey and the complexity of whiskey is down to the way in which the spirit and the wood have talked to each other over time. Now, wood is a pretty powerful... Wood can dominate that conversation quite easily. And as soon as wood begins to dominate that conversation, you begin to lose the individuality of the whiskey itself, and the whiskey becomes woody. So the key for a distiller is to try to find that sweet spot of balance between character of the spirit which has come off their stills, and the complexity and richness and flavours which are coming from the woods. So they've got to strike that balance spot on. The issue with the bourbon distillers is kind of coming back to that point that, by law, they're restricted to only being able to use brand new barrels. The brand new barrels are chock full of all the flavours in the wood, so they actually give their flavours out. It's a huge reservoir of flavour for the spirit to soak up. Also, you know, the climate in Kentucky accelerates that to a certain extent, because, you know, you've got, you know, extremes of temperature, so the whiskey's going in and out and in and out of the oak. So achieving that balance, it means that balance can be achieved earlier in Kentucky than it can in Scotland, where the climate is a lot cooler, where we're using second-hand barrels. So it means that in Scotland, you hit that sweet spot later on in the whiskey's life. And in bourbon, you tend to hit it that little bit earlier. The problem is that this obsession with putting age statements in bottles, which actually mean nothing.
the funny thing is, the second answer that you gave me was exactly the answer that I got from the people that I talked to, that in fact the aging process is much more rapid.
Yep.
Because the ambient temperature is much higher.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other part makes sense, that if you're using a new barrel all the time and you leave the whiskey in there too long, then it's going to take in much more wood than you want it to.
Exactly.
It's very clear, listeners, that Dave Broom is a real expert. He's done you a tremendous favor.
He's a very thoughtful drinker too.
so if you're really interested in an exploration of the world of whiskey, there's no better place to start. Perhaps Dave would suggest that his friend Michael Jackson's book on the same subject is pretty good too.
Yep, this one, indeed, yeah.
But this one is hugely authoritative, and I think...
And it's beautifully photographed. It's just a gorgeous photograph.
Yeah, thank you. The team back in London, they really pulled out the stops in this. So, yeah, it does look fantastic. A lot of photographer friends sort of came in as well, so it was great to see being able to exhibit some of their work as well.
Now, here's a tough one for you right before we sign off.
You
get to do this. You have to pick one. You have to pick one that's your favorite. If you really twist my arm, I might let you get away with two, but no more than that. What the top of your list all time?
Well, I mean, I always say, you know, my favorite whiskey is the one that's in my glass at that particular moment. So, you know, if the ship is going down, it's going to be the one that's in my glass at that moment. It's one of these questions I get asked a lot, and I always try and wriggle out of them. Simply because if you look at Scotland, for example, there's 96 distilleries operating in Scotland at the moment. All of them are releasing at least four or five different expressions officially. And then there's lots of independent bottlings. And then you look at the Renaissance in bourbon, you look at Canadian whiskey coming on, you look at all the Irish coming on, plus all the whiskies from around the world. It is impossible to say that one will rise above all others, because it depends on your mood, it depends on the season, it depends on the time of day, it depends on the company.
That was pretty snarky, just like a Scotsman. you probably have some Campbell in your ancestry, I wouldn't wonder. and that's an inside joke. Only those people from England and Scotland will understand. Dave, thank you so much for joining us today. We are grateful to have your book. If you're interested in the subject of whiskey, whether you're an advanced one or a beginner, there's something in this book for you, and Dave is in the process of building a website. So, Dave, why don't you announce that, and then people can check in the future and find out what's going on.
That's it. You know, I'm in the process of writing or setting up the website simply because you need to be out on the net these days, and I've got so many tasty notes and new things arriving in the house and sort of limited areas to talk about them. I might as well do them myself. So DaveBroom.com will be coming soon.
DaveBroom.com not co.uk. Good old-fashioned US.com.
Good old-fashioned US.com.
Okay, DaveBroom.com is where you'll need to go for future information, but in the meantime, get your hands on this book. You'll enjoy it. Dave, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
And now it's time for another break, so stay with us and we'll talk to you again on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are, back on the other side. Next up, you may think that it's an odd choice for this time of year when it's so wintry and chilly out, but popsicles are becoming a big hot story, and boosting that is this whole team of industrial designers who have designed the Quick Pop. So let's hear it for Zoku.
Listeners, I fell in love with this. I'm a craft-minded person anyhow. But when I saw this wonderful popsicle kit called Quick Pop, I just freaked out, all the possibilities. Ken Zorovich, you are an industrial designer, and you and a partner, a friend, dreamed this up?
Yeah, so we're a collective of designers and engineers.
Okay.
So we have a team of 5 people. And we're growing now, but when we started, we were 5 people, and we wanted to do something innovative in the housewares industry.
Oh, okay. So you pinpointed that.
Well, we pinpointed that, and we looked at ice pops, and I saw what was existing on the market, and I said, this hasn't changed since I was a child.
Right.
And when I was a kid, I loved, in the summer, I would just make orange juice pops all summer long.
Uh-huh.
And I said, there are very few things that haven't changed at all in this amount of time. So we came back to our studio and we said, what could we do with ice pops? And we started brainstorming all of these ideas. And then one of the guys on the team said, well, what if we could make a fast? And from that, you know, everybody just kind of stopped and said, well, that would be really cool, but how can you do it? So then we went off and explored the methods for doing that.
So you use liquid nitrogen?
It's not liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen would freeze them really fast.
And also, it might be dangerous around
children.
And it would
be dangerous.
Yeah.
So we had some technical challenges to develop the technology, apply for all of the patents to protect the invention, and then also create something that was going to be manufacturable and also safe. So that was where we started, and we built prototypes, and we started to discover that we actually could make them faster, and then we had to solve some problems of removing the pops from the mold, because without a removal method, pops won't come out. So we had to develop that technology as well, and then apply for patents and protect all of our intellectual property along the way before we released it to the market. And so that's where it started.
So was a year ago, or?
Well, this is going back almost 3 years, just about 3 years ago when started.
See, listeners, you may have good ideas, but it's the carrying it through to implementation that's the challenge. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So then what we discovered along the way was we were very engineering focused, and we weren't really focusing on food because we were just working on the device.
Uh-huh.
And as we started using our prototypes more and more, we started to discover things about it. So we discovered that using it was actually fun. And we also discovered that you can make cream-filled pops by sucking out the inside when it's halfway frozen. You can make striped pops very easily. And then we also found that you can put fruit slices on the wall and then pour your juice in. And we discover that it turns into a really fun activity.
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely. I mean, it just caught my eye immediately. As I said, I'm a craft person, you know, and the possibilities are endless with this.
Right, and that's, so the craft word, the word that you use, craft, is great because that's exactly what we were finding, that making these things, you don't really know what they're going to look like until you pull them out, and they all have their own. They're kind of like snowflakes where each one is different and they're always beautiful.
In my crazy youth, I was the master of sand cast candles.
Oh, wow. So there's some similarities there. I remember that actually when I was a kid. My
yeah.
Brother was
doing. Oh, yeah. There's a lot, there's a lot of eating involved in a sand cast candle. Now, this is awfully hard to even envisage just how magnificently designed this device is. So while you're listening to this, bring up another web browser window and go to Zoku, Z-O-K-U, Home, and you'll see what one looks like. And then you'll also see that these guys haven't stopped, because once the original product came to market, you realize that you needed accessories to go along with it.
That's correct. And what we found was when we first launched the product, we were so focused on getting the product out before holiday last year. So we launched the end of October 2009. And once we launched the product, we had a lot of demand from customers asking for recipes, asking for ways to store the pops in the freezer. There was a lot of passion that people were saying, we love Zoku, we love our Zoku, like, we need recipes, please help us. So we started realizing that we were getting such a strong following that we wanted to continue to build the brand and the experience for our customers. So we designed a storage case specifically made to hold the pop, keeps them fresh in the freezer, but it also creates a way to present these at a dinner party or at a kid's party or something like that, where we're taking it to the next level. Instead of, we think that this is, it's, in a way, it's an art form. You can make these very beautiful things that also taste really good, and now do something a little bit different for dessert rather than having cake or something that would be maybe a little heavier.
And this, of course, brings us to the question. I mean, it's unusual to have a one-product company or to start a company for one product, but there had been something very specific drawing you to this popsicle thing. And it has been rumored that that's sort of the next hot trend, adult popsicles particularly.
Yes, I can say that we didn't do this because of any trend. We didn't say, oh, popsicles are hot, we're going to do something with that. I think what we saw was that nothing had been done in the category in terms of making them at home, and we saw that as an opportunity. And it just so happens that as we were developing it, we started to see magazine articles about ice pops. We would see there's a store that opened up in the city, that in New York City, that sells pops.
Yeah, I made a note of that, and I don't know where I put it, that store.
Yeah.
What else do they sell?
I think that's it. I think all they have are pop. So it's definitely trending, which is great for us because now there's a lot of awareness around it, and people are just more aware of ice pops as an alternative to heavier dessert.
Now, you said you were working on some other new ideas as well, though. How much of those, Ken, can you disclose?
Well, we have a book that we created.
Okay, great.
It's called Zoku Quick Pop, and we have more than 40 recipes in the book that are all designed to be used with our pop makers. So we also have techniques in there, ways to put chocolate on the pops, how to make layers, and the recipes are amazing. They're just really, really good. So it's been fun developing the book, tasting the recipes, working with the writers of the book to come up with the recipes. Some of them are simple. Some of them are a little bit more complex. So we have something in there for everyone. And we also have the toolkit. I think I talked about the storage case, but not the toolkit. And the toolkit provides simple tools that allow you to do more advanced techniques. They're still easy to do, so you can do very interesting designs on the pop, the likes of which I don't think anyone has ever done before. So if you see on our website with the toolkit, you can see, like, we have Valentine's Day pop. We have very unique striped pops with angles. We also have an American flag pop. And those are just the tip of the iceberg.
So at this stage, you're not doing new products outside of the realm of pop?
I can't really say everything that we're doing,
but we
have new products that are going to be launching next spring. Almost everything that we're doing now is Zoku.
So Zoku, okay.
Propeller was the former company that was our design firm that started Zoku, and Zoku has taken up so much of our time that we decided to really focus on developing the company further. It required all of our attention, so.
Wow. So I'm going to end up spending half of my life making popsicles. Is that it?
You mean me?
Me.
You, okay. Well, that's good, and luckily you'll be able to make them a lot faster. So the great thing about our device is that we discovered that we created something that can make an ice pop 8,500% faster than the traditional method. And what we thought was really interesting with this was there are very few products, I can't think of any actually, that improve the speed of something so dramatically with one product introduction. And I think that's what's captured the imaginations of people, is that no one really thinks of it that way. But when they use it, there's a certain magic that's very real when you use the product. There's a certain experience that you have when you use it that I always tell people, when you see someone use it for the first time, watch their face. And they pull a pop out, and there's always a sense of delight when they make it, especially for the first time. And then when you start doing fun design, it happens even more. Well, so that's been really fun. So if you spend the rest of your life making pops, you'll be able to make a lot more than you did the other way.
Well, Ken, thank you for teasing us about the fact that you can't tell us what's coming next, but as soon as you can announce it, you must let us know.
Well, I'm on his mailing list, so I get the emails.
No, I mean, we wanted it as a scoop. As soon as it can be released to the world, we deserve to have it on the menu.
We will definitely let you guys know.
And he wants a scoop. That's ice cream.
It's pretty close.
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, congratulations. You sound like you're having a lot of fun doing this.
We are. It's really been a great experience. And, yeah, it's really fun. We've always wanted to develop our own product and see if we could be successful. So it's been fun to see it grow. And in January, we've been exclusive with Williams-Sonoma for the last 12 months or so. And in January, our products will be available in other stores across the country. And we're also shipping internationally as well. So our products are in Europe, Australia. I don't even know all the countries. I think we're in like 5 to 7 countries.
Oh, that's great. That's great news.
Yeah,
we're about
to go into Japan. That's really fun, too, to see how.
Can you put alcohol in these things?
You can. A lot of people ask us that.
Because it doesn't freeze that well, does it?
Well, beer and wine will freeze. They may take a little bit longer. And you can also do small amounts of harder alcohol.
Well, you can add it into the mixture, right?
You
can certainly add it into the liquid mixture.
Right.
And just have to be careful not to put in too much, otherwise it won't ever set.
Exactly. So if you pour in vodka into the molds, that won't freeze, but beer and wine will. You can make mimosas, that'll work.
That'd be fun. I can just see having a brunch and doing this. I think that's fun. Well,
right.
Don't forget to keep us posted. I'm particularly interested in this book. And in the meantime, do your website one more time.
Zokuhome.com, ZOKUHOME. And if you go to our shop, you can see our full selection of products. And our book will be in there over the next couple of weeks, and we're going to send out an announcement. And the other thing I would like to mention, if I can, people can follow us on Twitter or Facebook or sign up for our email letter. And what people will get is a free recipe subscription. So in addition to product updates and things like that, people will get recipes delivered to them through the social media channels, and then they'll have new recipes that they can use with the pop maker. And if you go to our blog now, you'll see some of the ones that are already there, and we're really trying to provide great recipes for our customers so they can continue to try new things and experiment.
Yeah, I wanted to make a Santa Claus.
Yeah, so we have some Christmas things that we're working on, and there's all kinds of things you can do. So,
well, this is fun, and you're having a great time, Ken, and it's been fun talking to you and fun playing with the Zoku Pop Clip.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, and, yeah, thanks for trying our product.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Another week, another program, another show, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.